I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limewire Technical Net. We have a little bit more time if anyone is interested to bounce something less volatile around. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, feel free. Hit that push to talk.
Well, Roy, before I go, before I forget, let me wish you and your family and everybody else a good Yom Tov and a healthy New Year. WDHWW.
Thank you, Howie. Likewise to you and your family. Have an easy fast if you're fasting, and have a happy and healthy New Year. And I thank you, and I appreciate your participation and your enthusiasm.
Thank you, Howie.
Yeah. The only thing I wish is Dick was here. I miss him. He went to the same school, same alma mater. We had some of the same instructors, just a few years apart. So what can I say?
I understand. We all miss him. We do this in memory of him. But, you know, time marches on. You can't reverse things. You can't bring people back from the dead, unfortunately. We all cared a great deal for Dick, and we keep his memory in our hearts.
He was a very interesting character. I liked the way you do the TechNet. He wasn't sometimes too long. He sometimes, as an engineer, I understood it. It was almost like being in a lecture hall. But he was a very smart guy. But sometimes you just have to give the answers. But again, whatever. Just thinking about past people in my family. I can't believe it, Roy. I'm 70 years old. You know, time marches on.
Yeah, you can't stop it. You can't slow it down. You just have to deal with it as best you can.
Yeah, you got to be thankful, I think.
Well, that's always good. I mean, because if you're not thankful, the opposite of that is just kind of eats you up inside. The worst kind of thing is to just, keep it all stuck in your head and be upset with what people should have done or did or could have done or all kinds of shoulda, woulda, couldas going around there. So, try and make life easier for the next guy, and hopefully he'll do likewise for you. My object in life is to leave this world a better place than I collected it from. So hopefully I'll be able to say that I did that, if I'm able to say anything.
That's why I like ham radio.
Yes, it is a multifaceted technology hobby that you could take all kinds of different ways, and everyone has taken them every which way. And it fascinates me even to this. There are guys tinkering around with even new technology as far as I'm aware. So it's a great hobby. I put in a lot of time on it, and I hope I continue to put in time on it. And I think it's a rewarding way of spending your time.
Well, by having the intention to make the world better, you know, that also can be very, fulfilling. You get some kind of encouragement about it, and you act with that intention.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of people I know that are kind of selfish. It's kind of, what's in it for me? I think that's a terrible attitude. I mean, many of them are very, very successful, and maybe it fulfills them. So, I guess ultimately you have to find what fulfills you as an individual, and nothing particular can be kind of chiseled on a big stone monument and be the instructions for each and every one of us, because we're all different, and we have different attitudes towards things, and so not everyone could take that path. There are others who take a more selfish path.
Well, I try to accept people as they are, and maybe in a person's life than make the realization that, you know, a change is not such a bad thing.
Well, you know, that's another philosophical thread. Are people capable of change? I think people are capable of change. I don't think every single person accomplishes that in their lives. There are some that, unfortunately, for one reason or another, never come to that conclusion and never fundamentally change. But I won't say definitively, you know, if you did something bad once in your life, you're marked for the rest of your life and you're only capable of doing bad things. I think that's too simplistic a concept for something as flighty and irrational as humanity.
Well, you know, if somebody is selfish toward me or toward anybody else, you know, how to say there is a better way and there's different things people can do. Maybe we can somehow connect and become friends for that.
Perhaps, and in some cases that's a reality, and unfortunately in other cases it's never a reality. There are people who have learned lessons in their lives that were detrimental to, you know, their interactions with other people. It colored their interactions, and they were unable to kind of give up those chains, and they wrapped them around themselves for even more security. So it depends. You know, we're all different. We all have different foibles, and some of us come to a realization of things being more important than other things, and others just never do.
Also, some people that struggle to depend on themselves for many things, and they want to find out something from you, or the one to take advantage of you, or the one to take something from you. And how to say, if this happens to me, no, I don't really need that at all. I have no need for it at all. And there's no reason for it to continue on.
Okay. Howie, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you talk about selfishness. I'm just curious, are you talking about in terms of somebody trying to make a lot of money and that's all they're into, or, I mean, it all depends on what someone does with their life. I mean, there's some people who are into spirituality, there's some people who, you know, don't want to make a lot of money, just want to help people, and there are other people who want to start corporations and make billions of dollars. But you got to look at the people who want to make a lot of money also provide jobs. So, you know what? Different things for different people, different strokes. I'm just curious what your definition of someone being selfish, meaning not wanting to pay taxes, or someone who doesn't want to let immigrants in. I'm just curious.
I don't want to kind of reduce a political tomes. Selfishness isn't only money. All the things that we aspire to one degree or another, some people aspire to much more and are willing to pay terrible prices. It doesn't have to be particularly money. It could be fame. It could be other things. It's just that, you know, some people are trying to collect things excessively. There's, you know, money is very useful. Why exactly you need $400 billion, I'm not quite sure. And I think if you sit these guys down, they said, because it's cool, or something similarly philosophy-free. But I'm not just talking about billionaires. There are poor guys who are very selfish inherently. They're jealous. They're envious of relationships, and they act out because of it. So there's a lot of other ways of being selfish that's not necessarily monetary as its basis.
One thing about me, you know, I don't get jealous. If somebody has $1 billion, well, I don't have $1 billion. You know, more power to them. But you know, take a lot of these guys, I don't know. You know what, take the guys who started Apple. They started building their computers in a garage, and look at what happened. A lot of guys, you know, if people don't have that ambition, saying, I want to get rich, then you're not going to have a lot of the technologies. I mean, I think capitalism is the best of all systems. That's what I agree with. But you also have to take care of people who are less fortunate. I mean, people who are disabled. I don't think you have to throw money at people who just don't want to work. But you definitely got to take care of people who, no fault of their own, have certain issues. That's where I'm coming from. But you got to take care of your own before you take care of others. And, you know, you should at least give 10%, tithing. That's what the Bible says. So, back to you, Roy.
Okay, you know, this isn't a religious country, so thankfully we don't tithe. And most of the time we have non-regressive taxes. It's inherently regressive to tax everyone at the exact same percent because you take a lot of the absolute amount of money away from poor and middle-class people, and wealthy people collect more, and there has been an increasing change in the, you know, who owns the wealth of the country. It hasn't been this, you know, extreme since, I think, the 50s or the 40s or something. It was much greater non-regressive taxes in the Kennedy administration and the Eisenhower administration. But we'll leave that for the political net at 3:30 in the morning. Thank you again, Howie. It's 10:18. Certainly time for a poll, WS2N with the Spet Report.
Thank you, Roy, KG2R1.
Good night, WDHWW.
This is WS2N. Very good. Yeah, we need a political net. Wow. AC2GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, I don't have all that much to go through. We'll cover a couple of topics anyway. Let me just stand by and see if anybody wants to ask a question dealing with the space program. Okay, European Space Agency, very active decades. They don't want to be left behind with rocket technology, that's for sure. They have the couple of the big rockets that they use. It's the Ariane 6 and the Vega rocket. Vega is a solid rocket, you know, solid fuel. The Ariane 6 is liquid hydrogen on both stages, first stage and second stage. So that's a heavy lift vehicle. One thing that they don't have is reusability, but they are working on that now. I just saw a picture of a completed stage that they're going to be testing. It's called the Themis rocket. They're going to test it out of Sweden. They have a launch complex over there. But, you know, it's got legs and everything. The goal is to eventually develop this into a much larger rocket. I mean, this thing's pretty big as it is, like 100 feet tall. And probably about 12 feet in diameter. But that will only be, really a test rocket to see if they can launch it, take off, not go into orbit, and then come back and land. But in the future, they plan on having bigger rockets. So, you know, it's not only Elon Musk with his Falcon 9 rockets that are into reusability. many other companies. We have other American companies that are really involved in it. There's Stoker company. They should probably be launching their first rocket maybe by the end of this year or early next year. Complete reusability. What's the name of the other company? I'm trying to think of it. You put an R, I'll think of it. But there's another one that should be coming to life maybe middle of next year. That's the future. Let's put it that way. Any comments on reusability? I mean, Russia does not have it. China is working on it. Right now, we have two companies that do it now. Rocket Lab, of course, that's what I was thinking of. Rocket Lab has reusability with the Neutron rocket that's coming up, and that should be the first launch by the end of this year as well. So the cost of launching rockets overall has already come down, and it will continue to do so. Anyway, we'll see what happens in the near future. But right now, we have a couple of other rockets that will eventually do that, and that's the New Glenn, and that was supposed to be launched by the end of this month on the 29th. But now that's going to be delayed. They've had one successful launch already. They were unable to catch the first stage. That was about January. The second attempt will be soon, I guess, within about a month or two. And that will launch out of Virginia and, out of Florida and come back down and land on a drone ship off the coast of Florida. And that would be a heavy lift vehicle, direct competitor with SpaceX. Any comments? Okay, International Space Station is doing well. It's coming up to its 25th year in operation. Started in 2021. Actually, the first pieces that went up was the end of 1999, but it's been occupied almost 25 years now. They have 7 people on board on a regular basis. That number keeps changing, as they change crews, but, it's really home for 7 people at a time. They need plenty of supplies that go up. The Progress resupply vehicle by Russia went up a few weeks ago. That's docked to the space station with another Progress vehicle presently docked to it. But then on the American side, we have two cargo vehicles now docked at the space station. One, the Dragon cargo resupply vehicle without a crew, it's just a cargo vehicle that's attached. And now the Northrop Grumman version, the Cygnus, they call it the XL, just docked with the International Space Station a couple days ago. And that one has increased in size. I remember it used to fly maybe no more than 5,000 pounds of cargo up. They increased the size, a couple of years later, and they were starting to send, 7,000 or 8,000 pounds of stuff up. Now this last one that just went up, which is, it launched last week, was filled with 11,000 pounds of stuff. They extended the cylinder of this vehicle another 5 feet, so Now, overall, this thing is like, I don't know, 25, almost 30 feet long and about 14 feet in diameter. So it's now a large cargo vehicle, permanently not docked, but berthed to the one of the ports. It's called Node 1 Harmony. You have different names to these different ports. And this is now docked to Node 1. It's got 16 bolts, motorized bolts. When it gets close to the space station, it's grabbed by a robotic arm by the crew, and it's placed into its location. And then these 16 5/8-inch bolts mechanically tighten everything up. It creates a permanent seal. And they could actually leave it there forever, or in the case of Cygnus, they'll leave it there for about 200 days, and they'll load it up with tons of trash and everything else. Eventually, it will separate from the space station, and it's not even done with its job at that point. As it separates, it has a couple of CubeSats attached to the vehicle. It'll actually be a satellite by itself, and then they'll release CubeSats all before they eventually burn up over the South Pacific. But this particular cargo vehicle had a little trouble getting there. The launch by a SpaceX vehicle was successful, but the Cygnus cargo vehicle has its own engine, and it's supposed to fire for a certain amount of time to eventually get it up closer to the International Space Station. So it was in orbit, everything was fine. It was fine with it, but then they tried to dock with the space station. They needed to relight the engine, which it did, but then it kept shutting off early. And they were worried that, well, maybe they're not going to get these 11,000 supplies and scientific equipment to the space station. But the engineers back here on Earth figured out that it was a software problem. They had one of the limit switches, set. It was too sensitive. And they changed that software, sent the signal up to it, and that was successful. And the next time they ignited the engine, it was able to successfully dock with the International Space Station. So, very good work by the Grumman people. Anyway, that's a success. We'll see what happens in the future. We have another cargo vehicle going up in a couple of months by Japan. I mentioned that before in a that's called the HTV, and that's another large vehicle, and from what I understand, it's going to be about 11,000 pounds worth of stuff, too. So, the space station's a big place to be able to have a permanent crew of 7 modules. It's really like 15 different rooms that these people could be in at any one time. It's an amazing place. Any comments? Okay, all quiet. We're waiting for another launch coming up. Two days on Tuesday. SpaceX Falcon 9 is going to launch three spacecraft at the same time. They're going to put these spacecraft at the L1 position, Lagrange Point 1. That's a million miles away from Earth, in the direction of the Sun. So as we go around the Sun 365 days a year, in 1 year, these satellites will be doing the same thing. And they're going to be studying the Sun at that location. They could look at the Sun and all the chemicals and on the solar wind and everything that comes off of the sun on a continuous basis. They could also communicate with the Earth on a continuous basis. So in one direction, facing the sun, they have all the instruments. On the other side of the spacecraft, they have antennas pointing back to Earth to send back all the data. And there's a couple of satellites out there now that do that. But now, one of the ones that are important to be out there is this IMAP one. There's three of them going up. But IMAP is really by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. And they're the ones that are investing in this one. They really want to know about this gigantic protective bubble that surrounds actually the whole system, the solar system. You know, it's called the heliosphere. And that's what this one is really going to be studying. They'll be able to get much better measurements there than they could in orbit around Earth. So that's why they're sending it out. We'll see how IMAP does. Anyway, I hope that gets off the ground okay. I look forward to that launch on Tuesday. Any comments?
W2BZ.
Hi, Rich. You're not doing CW homework? I keep getting emails. It's endless. Anyway, back to you, Rich.
I know, and my first teacher ran it completely different than my second one. Completely different. I guess they just do what they want. There's no, curriculum for every teacher. And it's shockingly different than the first one. Anyway, I'm wondering, has the space station, in essence, paid for itself? I mean, what is it really doing of any importance? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, all these years, there's always an average of 300 experiments that are going on at the same time. You know, a lot of them by the crew, of course. But then the ones that the crew aren't doing, there's other experiments being done by the people on the land, around the world, not only us, but different mission controls around the world, the International Space Station. So there's all kinds of things they have. They have telescopes that are looking at black holes, and they have the alpha magnetic telescope thing that's attached to the space station. So you have astronomy, things that are going on a regular basis. You have medical, tons of medical stuff that they do all the time. They're always testing themselves, and eventually put things into freezes. When a SpaceX Dragon goes up, SpaceX Dragon, that comes back down, that doesn't burn up. They'll put all the experiments on that vehicle. They'll get back down safely, and then the scientists get to study all these different things. There's been a lot of advances in medicine. They use that as a platform for study. For instance, you had two astronauts, Scott Kelly and Mark Kelly, both independently were crew members and eventually commanded space shuttles. So they were highly experienced. And in the later years of the space shuttle, one guy completely retired, and that was Mark Kelly. Scott Kelly, he was still wanted to go, and so he went up for a year, a whole year in space, and they did all kinds of tests on him. You know, I mean, not just blood tests, but you know, all kind of DNA tests and God knows what else. When he was up in space, they did the exact same thing to his brother, his twin brother, who was here on Earth. You know, whatever he was eating up here, up there, Mark was eating down here. You know, they duplicated everything for like a year. And I'm sure all those test results, you know, scientists will be studying that stuff for, you know, many years to come. That's just one example. So, yeah, the cost of maintaining the International Space Station for us, don't forget there's 21 countries involved, but for us in America, it's around $4 billion a year. And then, you know, the other countries are pouring money into it as well. So, you know, it's expensive to maintain. But they do say that the science that they are getting out of it, you know, not necessarily short-term, but long-term. You know, they have to do studies and materials, different materials that they study, too. Crystal growth and all this for electronics, you know, it's all been studied, you know, over the decades. So, you know, as far as I know, it's the money, you know, the money that's been saved by having the space station outweighs the cost of keeping it up there. Back to you, Rich.
Could you point to, like, one experiment or one finding that the space station has made or that scientists on the space station have made that really blows all the other ones away? Is there one thing that has been discovered that is truly mind-boggling? Because I don't hear anything about it other than from you. Go ahead.
Yeah, NASA used to publish a book. I have one here somewhere every year of all the different things that they're doing that, you know, are beneficial to humankind. And but specific things, you know, I'm not a doctor or doctor research, but you know, they study things to do with the eye. I mean, you know, they study things to do with your bone. You know, that's supposed, you know, in the long run, we'll figure out, you know, arthritis problems. And, you know, but nothing specific. I know what you're looking for. Right now, off the top of my head, I really can't. These are studies that probably get lost in the, you know, in the news. That's for sure. You know, there's not like been one breaking news. You know, the space station has found, you know, a cure to leukemia. You know, nothing like that. Back to you.
What is it about space that these experiments could only be done in space?
Well, yeah, they call it microgravity. You know, certain things like, you know, they have 3D printing. Well, they have this 3D printing thing that's going on with, you know, biology. The goal is to eventually maybe maybe a liver or a kidney or something, you know, through these 3D machines. They won't be able to do it on Earth because of gravity. You know, gravity, you know, pulls things together here on Earth. If they're trying to, you know, create, you know, a bead of this or a bead of that, you know, one after the other, you know, on some kind of a, you know, a substrate. Where in space, they've experimented with the, with this, you know, in the early, you know, I mean, they haven't duplicated a kidney yet, but, you know, that might be a goal. The process is, you know, able to do, they're able to do it on the space station where they can't do it on Earth, and that's because of microgravity. And the same with growing crystals and all. Apparently, gravity on Earth to try to make these, you know, perfect crystals for electronics really can't be done on Earth as it could in space. And, you know, once that has been accomplished, you know, you could have been companies creating their own, you know, space station, making things in space. You know, that's one of the Amazon has a plan of doing something like that in the future. So, you know, these things don't happen overnight. It takes decades, but, you know, to stop doing it now would actually stop, you know, hundreds of experiments that are going on at a time on the space station. And by the way, they're really good for communicating with hams on Earth. You know, they contact the schools. So there's a lot of hams that go up there. Back to you, Richard.
I think they have to do a better job of PR, because the only time I hear anything of the space station is when astronauts are going there or coming back from there. Other than that, I follow the news very closely on a daily basis, and I just don't hear anything about the space station. Even minor things about, you know, what they're finding up there. So I think they need to do more publicity, or somebody's going to start questioning the expense. Does Congress have any trouble with the expense of the space station?
So far, they're good to go. You know, they have cut NASA funding. They're trying to anyway. For next year. So, you know, there's been a lot of layoffs. They've gone from that $25 billion a year, roughly $25 billion. I think they're losing $9 billion of that. So they're cutting a lot of science-related topics. Space station is scheduled to actually deorbit around 2030, 2031. So, you know, it's finite. You know, I think personally they could keep it going, you know, further. But again, they've got this like $4 billion a year bill to keep it going. You know, when I say keep it going, you have to launch rockets to replace the crew. You know, you send people up four at a time now on the American side. And they stay for roughly a half a year, and then they come back. You know, those rockets cost money. These cargo vehicles I was talking about before, they do about 10 or so launches per year of cargo vehicles. On the Russian side, they send three people up at a time. Again, they stay for a half a year, sometimes a year. And then, you know, they'll send a crew up, and then after they're up, the other crew comes down, you know. And this has been going on now since 2021. Originally you had a crew of two, and then three on a regular basis, and that number kept increasing. Now we're up to seven permanently on board. So, there's movement from other companies like Amazon, European Space Agency. They want to build their own space station after this thing is gone. Axiom. They send crews up on a regular basis, that, you know, for only no more than 2 weeks. They dock with the space station. So during that 2 week period of time, there's 11 people on board the space station, and eventually they come back. They don't stay that long. But Axiom is a company that they have a module now that's almost complete. Their goal is to send that up, I guess soon, attach it to the front of the space station, big module, living module, and then a couple more modules after that, and have that, anyway, temporarily, it's all attached to the space station, the front of the space station. 2030, 2031, when they plan on deorbiting it, these gigantic three or four modules will separate from the space station and become their own space station. It's called the Axiom Space Station. And it'll be free flying. It's got its own solar panels and all. And eventually you'll have cargo vehicles and crew vehicles going up to supply the Axiom Space Station. There's other ones planned as well. European Space Agency has one. Amazon, you know, Jeff Bezos has a big one planned. Orbital Reef, they call it. Orbital Reef is so big that by the time they're done with building that thing, you'd have a permanent crew of 10 on board. Now, not to be outdone, you know, we have another space station up there right now, and it's not we, but it's China. And China has the Tiangong space station. It's gotten big enough where they now have a permanent crew on board of 3, and they're doing what we do, you know, they'll go up for a half a year, and the next crew will go up. But, you know, it's not as big as what we have, but still, it's functional. Permanent crew of 3, the spacewalks and everything. So, you know, don't forget, if we deorbit, let's say we do deorbit that thing now, the only permanent space station that will be up there will be China. That won't, you know, that doesn't look too good. Back to you, Rich. WS2N.
WS2NW2BZ. So you're saying that in 2031 it's over, they're going to deactivate it in 2031?
Yeah, right now the plan is 2030, but I'm going to guess that they're not going to be ready until 2031 or maybe 2032. You know, best laid plans of NASA. You know, they make predictions, and sometimes they don't even come true. But, yeah, right now there's a contract out with SpaceX to send a special uncrewed Dragon that they're building to attach to the International Space Station at some point, with these big Draco rocket engines sticking out of the back of the trunk. And then, you know, they'll put it on the front of the space station. Right now, you know, the American side is like the front, and then the Russian side is like the back. When they boost the space station, it's usually boosted by the Russians. They just accelerate the speed, and it eventually goes to a higher orbit. To deorbit, what they plan on doing is taking this Dragon vehicle, attach it to the front of the International Space Station, light it off, you know, with these big Draco engines, because, you know, you're trying to slow down over 1 million pounds. That's what the space station weighs. Just slow it down enough where it starts to deorbit, but, it's critical. They don't want this thing to come down over Europe. You know, the idea is to have it come down over the South Pacific. You might remember when Mir was deorbited, looked like, you know, fireworks coming out of the sky. You can still find that on YouTube, I guess. And that was a big space station. That had like 5 or 6 modules attached to it by the Russians. In fact, we used to go up there with space shuttles. There were 5 independent space shuttle missions that actually went up to the Mir space station that the Russians had built. And that's how, you know, one of the ways we really got involved with Russia in the first place was the International Space Station. With Mir. Yeah, Mir ran for 15 years for the Russians. That was like a fire trap, you know. I mean, that they had a lot of problems with that thing, but they said they got a lot of science out of that. We sent our own people up. I think Norm Daggett was the doctor. He went up there, and he went up there for, you know, months at a time on Mir. So there's been, always a deal with Russia, even during the Soviet times. Mir was one of them. So, you know, eventually that will happen to the International Space Station. They'll deorbit that thing. And hopefully by that time we'll have, you know, 2 or 3 space stations, you know, of our own. We're involved with Europe, like I said. Europe is planning a big space station of their own. International Space Station, there's 21 countries involved with the International Space Station. 21. Back to you, Rich.
But what about it is, going to become irrelevant? Why don't they just leave it up there? Are there non-renewable energy sources on it, or is something running out on it, Paul?
Yeah, they have their own thrusters, you know, to push them into a higher orbit. Don't forget, if nothing happens, you know, you don't reboost the space station at all right now. It's going 17,500 miles an hour. Don't touch it. No more reboost. This thing will not continue to orbit forever. It would be like Skylab. You know, they didn't reboost Skylab, and that thing eventually deorbited. They rolled the dice on that one. I think part of it landed in Western Australia on land. Eventually, the little molecules that are up there, it's rarefied, but, you know, there are molecules, and it will tend to slow down the International Space Station, and eventually it starts to get lower and lower, and then it always has to be reboosted. When we had the shuttle, they had plenty of power in the shuttle. Before every shuttle came down, they would always reboost the space station. It would go up like 14 miles. Now, with what we have is every time a Progress vehicle goes up, which is a Russian, they'll get it up maybe about a mile or two. And now we're able to do that now with the Cygnus cargo vehicle and with the Dragon too. So, you know, every time they get a chance, they increase the height of the space station. They also used to keep the space station a little lower too. It's 250 miles up. They used to keep it around, you know, 10 or 12 miles lower. And they did that because it was easier for the space shuttles to get to it. But now that space shuttles are gone, they put it into a higher orbit, and they don't need to boost it as much, but they still have to boost it, which means fuel, the spacecraft going up there to refuel it. They just can't leave it, unfortunately. You know, so either you have to keep reboosting it, or sooner or later it's going to come down. To actually make it go, not faster, but where you don't have as much drag, sometimes they'll take those solar panels. Don't forget, those solar panels, each one of them are 40 feet long. 40 feet wide and almost 200 feet long. What they'll do is they'll make them go, you know, edge on, going first. This way, any molecules that are up there won't be hitting the solar panels. Solar panels are facing a certain way. it will slow it down more. So they can do that, which the reason they do that is, let's say there's going to be space junk flying by, and you know, instead of using the thrusters, they could turn the solar panels in such a way where, you know, it would be like on a sailboat. You know, you could just turn the sail, and you're not going to pick up any wind. That type of deal. And a lot of things that they do with the space station to keep it afloat. Back to you, Rich.
I didn't realize that objects in space have to constantly being boosted so they don't go lower and lower and lower and finally fall out of space. I didn't realize that. That's with asteroids and everything else up there, right? What about satellites? Regular satellites from Starlink satellites, do they have to be boosted?
Yes, they do. By the way, there's an average of 3 to 5 satellites every couple of weeks coming down from Starlink. They have over 8,000 up there now. But, yeah, they're at, 300 miles up, about 100 miles high. Well, 50 to 75 miles higher than the space station. But it's still rarefied molecules up there. I mean, it's a stronger vacuum than you would get in a vacuum tube. But it's the little molecules that hit the space station tend to slow it down. And the same thing with the satellites. Now, you get up to the higher ones, you don't have that as much of a problem, like the GPS satellites. They're about half the distance between Earth and the geosynchronous satellites. Geosynchronous satellites, very seldom, you know, do they need to be, you know, they have ion thrusters
down
there.
Time complete.
To help it move it from one location to another, but they're so high up that, you know, they could actually stay up probably, you know, maybe hundreds and hundreds of years. And same with the GPS satellites at 11,000 miles up instead of 23,000 miles up. But the ones that are lower, they have to be reboosted. Now, Hubble is at, I think Hubble is around 375. That one's okay, but eventually that will eventually slow down too. That's why they have they want to put a contract out with SpaceX or somebody to eventually attach to the Hubble and reboost that. But this is what happens. Satellites that are around the moon has very, very little atmosphere, molecules. So you have the lunar orbiter that's up there now. It's been up there since 2009. Doesn't need any kind of reboost because there's, like, no molecules to worry about with that thing. No atoms to hit. So, yeah, I'm trying to think of anyone else. I'll see. Well, you don't want to put the space station at, you know, 500 or 600 miles up, because then you're going to be near the Van Allen belt. So now you got a radiation problem. So that's why they keep it at this 250-mile height. Anyway, back to you, Rich.
Fascinating. I wasn't aware of any of this. And that's what I was going to ask you. Why don't they just put the space station, you know, higher, but you get into radiation problems or whatever? Anyway, Paul, fascinating stuff. Thanks. WTBC, I'll be clear. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, Rich, thanks for getting on talking about this. We'll keep following the space station stories and all the space activities. we'll be here next week. Continue to do the same. Right now, we got up to around 11 o'clock. We tend to close down. In the old days, we used to keep going all the way till 12 o'clock. Remember that? Anyway, we're going to turn it back to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night for the club net. That usually comes on at, well, it always comes on at 8:30 on these repeaters. And that's always followed by the Swapping Shop. And then that's followed by Radio Newsline. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N, for the Space Net Report, for the TechNet. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the Technical Net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I appreciate it as well. And I appreciate everyone out there who participated tonight. I hope you learned a few things. I hope you were entertained, informed. And I hope you'll join us again next Sunday when we do it all over again at 8 p.m. As per usual, I will quote a few very clever people. One, our own Dick, H-R-I-W, who always ended his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And the other, good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain falls out. So you might need it one of these days. Anyway, to people who are celebrating Rosh Hashanah, have a happy, healthy New Year. To those who aren't, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. And as always, I will close this particular episode of the Limark TechNet with a simple phrase, Slava Ukraini.
Shana Tova to you, Roy, WB2BX.
Hey, Frank, 73. Did I not leave enough space? Did you try to get in?
No, I didn't. We got a Rosh Hashanah family dinner at a Chinese restaurant. Yeah, I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but that's what the tradition and my wife's family get.
Okay, very good. Sounds good. Yeah. Anyway, have a good rest of the week. We'll catch you next week. Hopefully I'll be here next Sunday. 73, right, WS2N.
73, thank you. Thank you all, YX.
73, Roy, WB2BX.
W2VL repeater. Thank you.